The primary sources of value today are time and knowledge. And knowledge is contained within the technology that is used in every business and in every part of your life. Your ability to adapt and adjust to the incredible rate of speed at which technology is advancing and affecting every area of your life is absolutely indispensable to your success and your sense of well-being. The shifts that are necessary for you to become a fully functioning person in the technological age require, above all, that you change from technophobic or fearing technology to technocratic or looking forward to technology. That you move from viewing technology as a threat to your established way of doing things to your viewing technology as a powerful way to assist you to achieve your goals faster. When we say time and knowledge, we mean the ability to get the knowledge that you need in a form that you can use and then to apply that knowledge quickly to get a result for which someone else will pay. Virtually all technological advances are aimed at reducing the amount of time or expense or both it takes to achieve a particular objective. The technological improvements may be aimed at reducing the number of mistakes, the amount of effort, the quantity of energy used, or in speeding up the various processes, but they're all aimed at reducing the amount of time and expense it takes to get the job done. When you begin to look at technology as containing countless opportunities for success, achievement, and wealth creation, you begin to see technology as something you can turn to your advantage if you can learn it and adapt to it faster than anyone else. Recently, Fortune magazine had an article entitled, Why Companies Fail. They gave six reasons, one of which is that companies lost their identity or a sense of who they were and what they stood for. But two of the main reasons why companies, and individuals for that matter, fail in the technological age are, first, their inability to recognize the impact that new technology will have on their business, and second, their inability to adapt the new technology to their business processes. When the automobile was invented, one of the biggest industries in America revolved around the manufacture of buggies, buggy whips, wheels, axles, harnesses, and so on. In conjunction with the buggies, there was a huge industry in raising horses, backed up by farms raising hay to feed them, barns to house them, veterinarians to assist them, and so on. The roads of every city in America were ankle-deep in horse manure with both the smell and the flies that went along with it. When the first automobiles began appearing, just like the new technologies today, the wagon and buggy manufacturers ignored them. They predicted that the horseless carriage would be a passing fad. They turned their attention back to their own work. When more and more cars appeared on the roads, the wagon and buggy manufacturers went to phase two. They kept redesigning their buggies and their advertising to sell the buggies until they were eventually out of business and became footnotes to economic history. However, among the buggy manufacturers were a few men of vision. They saw that they were in the business of transportation, of getting people from one place to another, and the methods of transportation were secondary to the goal. They recognized that the economies of the automobile would soon replace the cumbersome and expensive process of keeping horses fed, watered, and cared for, and they shifted into the manufacture of cars as well. Some of these buggy manufacturers became extremely successful manufacturers of the early automobiles, and both their designs and their factories were eventually merged into the various automobile companies as they grew. Many of us fall into the same trap of viewing new technologies as passing fads that will have little effect or impact on our lives or business. We even think that it is a little bit cute when people pick up and begin playing with the new products. We read about them in magazines and see them on television and think how nice it must be for others to be preoccupied with these gadgets. I remember when the first personal computers came out. I looked at them for a year and then decided to be really daring and purchase a PC for my basic office accounting, administration, and word processing activities. I had to hire someone from the outside who knew about computers in order to get advice on the best combination of hardware and software to purchase. When I installed the computer for the first time, I thought that I was really leading the field. Of course, I concluded that computers were not really for me. I was a big picture person. I was an idea man. I dealt in terms of concepts and interpersonal relationships. I didn't need to get involved with computers. Computers were for accountants and controllers and bookkeepers and other technically oriented people. I bought computers for my staff for some years, but I never made an effort to learn how to even turn one on. I fell into the trap that many people do. They feel that since computers came out after they started their working lives, they could keep their heads down and they would be able to get out of their working lives without ever having learned to use one. They make various excuses about not having enough time or not having any ability to operate a computer, and they continually procrastinate and avoid the hard effort of becoming computer literate. However, if you're in the world of work today, you must make the shift from the idea of computer literacy to a commitment to computer fluency. When the first fax machines came out, very few people had them or used them. Today, no one knows how they could have ever gotten along without a fax machine. When the touchtone telephones came along, they were a real switch from the old dial telephones. The same with the electronic calculators and today with cellular telephones. In every instance, these new innovations were greeted with predictions that they would be too expensive, too complicated, and not popular enough to carve out a sizable market. But the predictions were wrong, and that is all in the past. Today, the fastest-growing companies in America and in the world are high-tech companies committed to introducing new products based on the most current technology. These are some of the highest-profit companies and industries in America, and they are innovating at an incredible rate, putting themselves and others out of business faster than ever before. If you want to be successful today, you must invest the 50 or 100 hours necessary to become computer literate and then computer fluent. You have to learn how to use essential software, as well as modems, email, and fax. You must learn to play a computer the way a musician would play an instrument. Your computer must become an extension of your mind and abilities. Those who do not enter rapidly into the age of technology will quickly be left behind. The jobs requiring limited skills, limited knowledge, and limited abilities are disappearing at an incredible rate. Even our school system must be reorganized so that it produces well-educated young people who are competent and capable of taking their places and earning excellent livings in a high-tech, information-based society. The shifts that are taking place today are both far-reaching and accelerating. Wherever they are today, technology will move them further in the future. The train is already leaving the station. It's absolutely essential that you get on and become current with each new technology as it emerges so that you have a knowledge base to build on as the technology expands into the future. We are already moving from being hardwired to cellular and wireless. Cellular telephones enable you to communicate with almost anyone, almost anywhere. The cost of cellular telephones has dropped dramatically in recent years, as has the cost of using them on a monthly basis. When you get your first cellular telephone, you will probably wonder if you're going to be able to justify its cost. But after you've had a cellular telephone for even a few days, like a fax machine, you will wonder how you ever did without it. Your major source of frustration will not be how much you use it, but it will be keeping your telephone charged and your batteries replaced so that your telephone can continue to run for the ever-expanding amount of talk time that you will need it for. Once you've gone from computer literacy, where you know how to operate a computer, to computer fluency, where you can use a computer quite comfortably for a variety of tasks, your next shift is from desktop computers to laptop computers. The original laptop computers were large and bulky, like portable typewriters, and could only be called laptop with some exaggeration. But current laptop computers are getting smaller, sleeker, containing greater capacities, and having longer battery lives. A laptop computer today with a Pentium chip gives you more computing power than existed in the entire world prior to 1960. You can get a laptop computer today with enormous storage capacity and loaded with every program you could think of using away from your office. Not only that, the laptop computers coming out today have modern modem capacity built in so that you can tap into America Online, CompuServe, Prodigy, and that giant of databases, Internet, by plugging a connection to a telephone into your computer anywhere you happen to be. The technology is moving so rapidly that soon you will have a cellular telephone with speakerphone capacity built into your portable computer. This will allow you to tap into databases containing most of the information in the world from virtually anywhere with no wires at all. This same cellular telephone capacity with modem will enable your portable computer to receive faxes and email from distant locations. The technology of telecommunications and information processing is advancing so rapidly that a consortium of telecommunications companies is now planning to put a ring of 54 telecommunication satellites in orbit around the Earth. In conjunction with this, each person who subscribes will be issued with a personal telephone number. This ring of satellites will be so sophisticated that a person sitting in a rowboat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean will be able to use their cellular telephone to call a person sitting in a rowboat with a cellular telephone in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. You will not even have to know where another person is anywhere on the globe. All you'll have to do is have their number and call it. The satellite system will find the person and communicate with them in seconds. The sound of the transmission will be as crystal clear as if the individual were in the same room. Remember I said before that anything that works today is already obsolete. This means that the very fact that a layman such as myself could talk about these technological advances means that they are already moving toward obsolescence and being replaced by even faster and better forms of technology. Concerning online information databases that you can access from your computer with a modem, the Internet is the granddaddy of them all. The Internet is currently tied into something like 17,000 databases worldwide, all of which you can access by getting on and by cruising the Internet. And the Internet doesn't actually belong to anyone. It was set up by the federal government as a free-floating computer communication system that could continue to operate in the event of a nuclear war that destroyed the nation's capital or major cities. The Internet has now been made available to the world for commercial purposes, and people are signing up on it at the rate of about 1 million people per month. There are a whole series of books being published on how you can use the Internet for fun and pleasure. For many of us today, it is too complex, costly, and sophisticated to become an Internet user. But companies like Microsoft are rapidly developing software programs that will make Internet usage as simple as adding up numbers with a calculator. Because we have no choice about rapidly developing technology, you must make the shift from being a late arrival to being an early adapter. In every movement forward in human history, there are a small number of people, never more than 5 or 10%, who recognize the impact of the new technology and who adapt to it early. Then there are the people who follow the early adapters, and the people who follow behind them, and then the great majority who are the late adapters. These are the people who will only begin using the technology when it is already verging on obsolescence. These are the kind of people who buy a used computer with a 386 chip when the technology has already moved from a 486 to a Pentium chip. There are advantages and disadvantages in being an early adapter. The advantage is that you get a jump on your competitors by installing a faster, better way to get the job done before they do. The disadvantage is that the technology may still have bugs in it, and it may ultimately be abandoned in favor of something else. You must continually use your own good judgment in deciding whether you should be in first or whether you should be patient and wait for someone else to test the waters. There's another advantage to coming right in behind the early adapters. That is that the price of new technology drops rapidly after its introduction. The basic rule is that new technology is obsolete in 3 years, and at the 18-month point, halfway through, the cost of new technology drops about 50% in anticipation of the even newer technological advances hitting the market sometime soon. Nonetheless, you must make the shift from being the last on the block to being the first on the block. In the studies done on household use of technology, they find there is a direct correlation between the income of the home and the amount of new technology that the home contains. The higher the income of the homeowner, the more likely they are to have computers, modems, and fax machines in the house, and the more likely they are to have several computers. In the more technologically oriented households, they have even installed networks so that all the computers have access to each other, just like in the office. Now, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Do households become more prosperous and then install new technology, or do households install more technology and then become more prosperous? We know that companies that embrace new technology before their competitors often gain an edge over their competitors in the marketplace. Could it be that this happens at home as well? If you have children at home, it's absolutely essential that you have a computer for them, if not one for each child. Children learn computers very rapidly at an early age, especially if they include challenging computer games that the kids like to play. The computer games get them to look at technology as a source of fun and challenge, rather than as a source of drudgery and complexity. Once children become comfortable playing with the games on their computer, they tend to become comfortable with other forms of technology as well. Another shift you need to make is from occasional use of modern technology, including computers, to continual use of modern technology. One of the greatest enemies of human success is the comfort zone. We tend to slide back into the old way of doing things if we're not careful. For this reason, once you begin to use new technology, you need to use it every day if you possibly can. If you don't, you can quite easily revert to your old manual methods of doing things and become less and less capable of getting them done in the modern way. The technological revolution requires that you shift from acceptance of high technology to the embracing of high technology whenever you see that it can help you to be more productive in some part of your personal or work life. This requires a shift to your anticipating the success and benefits of technology rather than being preoccupied with the costs and difficulties of technology. By the way, there is a cost, a definite cost, to becoming technologically proficient. It is almost invariably defined in terms of the hours that you must invest to master a new computer or computer program. I personally invested between 50 and 100 hours and several hundred hours after that becoming computer proficient. For the first 50 hours, however, I was frustrated and tempted to give up the whole effort. I was beginning to think that I had no ability to learn how to operate this kind of sophisticated equipment. Then I read that Andrew Grove, the president of Intel, the biggest microchip manufacturer in the world, also had to invest about 50 hours on his own to learn how to operate a personal computer. The article concluded that there is no way other than by trial and error, accompanied by instruction whenever possible and various manuals for you to read, for you to get over the initial difficulties that everyone experiences. Remember, one of the great rules of success is that anything worth doing is worth doing poorly at first. If you're not willing to do it poorly at first, and often for many hours, you'll never reach the point where you become proficient enough to dramatically increase your productivity. The technological age requires that you move from a closed mind to being open-minded to all possibilities in the world of information processing. Your key aims in evaluating any new technology are to look for opportunities for one of four things. The first is leverage. How can technology, computers, modems, faxes, telecommunications, and other equipment give you a kind of leverage that enables you to accomplish far more with far less effort? For example, it used to be that when companies wanted to send a new piece of information on a new product, process, or price to their customers, they would have to print the material and arrange a mailing to be followed up by personal visits or phone calls to make sure that the right people had gotten the information. Today, however, you can program your fax modem into your computer to send a message directly to the fax modem of your customer or of anyone else who owns a fax modem. Now what companies are doing is that they prepare a news release in the form of a fax, and then they instruct the computer to send the fax to every single customer, usually during the night when the telephone lines are clear and the telephone costs are substantially lower. The whole thing can be done in less than 24 hours. In our office, whenever we want to send a message or a news release to our 150 or more associates and distributors throughout North America and the world, we merely program it into the fax, and they all receive the message within a few hours. It is far, far faster than mail, and even taking telephone charges into consideration, because of the time saving in getting the news out, it turns out to be far cheaper. In the state capitals and in Washington, D.C., the elected representatives are often getting thousands of faxes within 24 hours of the announcement of a position or a new policy. Major government initiatives have been defeated by somebody finding out about the negative effects described in the fine print, faxing a message throughout the nation to everyone who will be harmed by the legislation and having all those people fax messages to their congressman or senator. In less than a day, the entire country can be mobilized for or against a particular piece of legislation. The old method of writing letters to elected representatives is simply too slow anymore. The second thing you should look for in the use of new technology is multiplication. Just as the purpose of a manager is to multiply himself or herself times the number of people that report to him or her, the purpose of technology is to multiply the efforts of yourself and your company. Here is where the seven R's of reorganization, restructuring, reengineering, reinventing, reevaluating, refocusing, and regaining control all come in. Every one is aimed at increasing the quality and quantity of outputs relative to the quality and quantity of inputs. Their purpose is to enable you and your company to get more out of the same amount or less. It's to enable you to multiply your time, talents, money, and productive capability times the technology to increase your bottom line. So you must keep asking how you can multiply yourself by applying a particular innovation and technology to your current situation. Read the business magazines, especially the parts dealing with new products and new technology, and look for innovations that enable you to accomplish more with less. The third goal you have in the adoption of new technology is time reduction. The ability to incorporate speed into everything you do can be a key source of competitive advantage. Customers today are extremely impatient. They didn't know they wanted it until now, and now they want it yesterday. Any individual or company who can use technology to dramatically speed up the process of getting customers what they want and where they want it can gain an edge over their competitors and an edge in their business. I still consider myself a computer novice, but I'm always amazed when my computer expert friends show me what they call power commands on my computer. These are combinations of commands that a knowledgeable person can press to dramatically speed up the rate at which a function is performed. You need to also be looking for power commands in the technological developments around you that you can use to speed up your functions as well. The final element you need to seek in the application of new technology to increase your productivity is that of value creation. All wealth comes from creating value of some kind. You create value by serving your customers better and faster than anyone else can at prices that are comparable to or better than theirs. The keys to creating value are to reduce the time that it takes for your customer to enjoy a particular benefit, to increase the speed of service, like Domino's Pizza. The ways to increase value are to improve the quality, holding the price constant, or to lower the price, holding the quality constant, and in every way to give your customers the things they're willing to pay for in a faster, better, newer, cheaper, easier form. After Domino's Pizza became a nationwide chain with several franchisees in each market, they computerized. They established a single phone number in each market that a pizza customer could call. The pizza customer would give their phone number and zip code, and the computer would automatically route the pizza order to the Domino's Pizza closest to the customer. This enabled them to grow larger and larger and still maintain their 30-minute guarantee. Today, because of the miracle of telecommunications, when you telephone a company of any kind for any reason, your phone might be answered by someone anywhere in the country or anywhere in the world. A large computer software company that offers 24-hour-per-day troubleshooting uses satellites to communicate with its customers. When you phone the company any time during the 24-hour cycle or 7-day week, the satellite will pick up your call and relay it to the computer troubleshooters currently at work. As the world turns, you may get a voice on the other end of the line from Hong Kong, Singapore, Bombay, Tel Aviv, or Dublin during the hours when U.S. businesses are closed. EDS, the company originally formed by Ross Perot, has perhaps the most sophisticated travel reservation network in the world. They process millions of travel orders every month from all over North America and the world. When you call on a particular number, your call may be processed by different operators in different parts of the country, all hooked into a central computer so that your account is immediately accessible to any of them. This enables you to have personal travel agent service from virtually anywhere for virtually any reason. As you make the shift from seeing technology as an inevitable fact of modern life to seeing technology as your best friend, you continually look for ways to gain leverage in your work and your business, to multiply your capacities, to reduce the time necessary to achieve your goals, and to create value for your customers that would not be possible in the absence of the new technology. You don't have to become a computer operator or a computer wizard. Most of the technology being introduced today is increasingly consumer-friendly. If it's not, just wait for a few months and it will be. Technology should be as easy for you to use without a degree in mathematics as is your telephone or photocopy machine. Don't be afraid to invest several hours of trial and error until you get the hang of it, though. By the way, with regard to investing several hours, for you to use technology, you must be verbally fluent. You must be able to read and write well. It does no good to have the most modern and sophisticated computers if you cannot read what's on the screen. If for any reason your education has left you feeling uncomfortable about your ability to read and write quickly and well, you should move immediately to take remedial classes and bring your skills up to such a level that you can use technology without fear or frustration. In addition to this, you must also learn to touch type. There are touch typing programs that you can purchase and install on your computer and with which you can practice every single day until you get your typing ability up to 40, 50, and 60 words per minute. Fortunately, this is just a matter of time. A good typing course will recommend that you only practice with it for 1 hour per day. But if you do practice 1 hour per day for the next 3 months, you'll be able to use a computer keyboard with the same ease and confidence that you currently drive your car. It'll take a little while of getting used to, but Then you will have a skill that will improve as you use it and which will open up the world of computers and computer programs to you. In studying military history, I found two extensive studies that examined military exploits for more than 2,000 years to discover what it was that caused great victories and what it was that caused great defeats. The conclusions the authors came to are instructive, and they apply to your attitude and usage of new technology just as they apply to history. There are three primary reasons for failure and for great defeats in military matters. They are first, the failure to learn, second, the failure to adapt, and third, the failure to anticipate. The failure to learn means the unwillingness or inability of the generals in command to learn from their previous experiences. They often ignored their previous experiences and even hard-won experiences and kept on with a set of assumptions that were no longer valid. This certainly applies to technology and to many people in our changing world. The second reason for military defeat was the failure to adapt. When faced with rapid changes in the external situation, the losing generals failed to adapt their tactics and methodology to what was required at the time. They continued trying to do what had worked in the past without realizing that now their competitors, the enemies, had made those methods obsolete. This certainly applies to technology and to modern business as well. The third reason for military defeat was the failure to anticipate. This referred to the two reasons for business failure mentioned by Fortune. In military terms, the losing generals failed to think ahead and prepare for what the enemy might possibly do. In business terms, companies run into trouble because they fail to anticipate the impact and effect of new technology on themselves and their competitors. Don't let this happen to you. On the other hand, there are three reasons why great generals win. The first is innovation. They continually seek creative ways to organize and reorganize their resources so as to attack the enemy in a different way and in a different place than they anticipate. The second is surprise. Successful generals always do the unexpected, attacking from the left when the enemy is prepared for an attack from the right. In adopting new technology, you must also be looking for new ways to better utilize your existing resources and to surprise your competitors by doing something completely different from what they had expected. The final ingredient of success practiced by winning generals is that of speed. Perhaps there's nothing more important in achieving competitive advantage in today's impatient, demanding marketplace than the habit of doing things fast. As Alan Lakin, the time management expert, said, "Fast tempo is essential for success." As long as you continue to look eagerly toward new technology and toward advances in computers and telecommunications as opportunities to save time and money and to do things faster and better than anyone else, you will be a full-fledged participating member of the technological revolution. And this will eventually guarantee your success in whatever you do. America is a good country because Americans are good people. Of all the countries in the world, America offers more opportunities for the creative individual to fulfill his or her potential than any other land at any other time. And if anything, the opportunity for you to be, have, and do all the things you want in life are expanding at a more rapid rate today than ever before. Your main job is to learn how to integrate yourself into the American economic and political system to assure that you get the very best and most of the blessings and benefits that America has to offer. But all is not roses. There are many misunderstandings and difficulties in American political economy today. And since everything that you do is done within the context of the larger political environment, and since government policies, taxes, and regulations have an inordinate impact on everything that you do or don't do, it's essential that you have an understanding of how the system works if you're going to take maximum advantage of it in achieving your goals. Just as we have made a series of major shifts in thinking and behavior in the areas of values, goals, time, relationships, business, learning, and technology, and so on, we are also going through a series of radical shifts in our ideas and conclusions about the role and nature of government in our lives and in our communities. Those who are most sensitive to and aware of these shifts in thinking and in society will be in a better position to function effectively than those who are not. Most people, and most business people for that matter, have very little interest in political economy and very little knowledge of the subject. Most people have opinions, attitudes, ideas, and values about political economy that have been formed with very little thought. Political economy can be either a dry subject or a very exciting subject, depending upon where you're coming from and your level of knowledge of the subject. The more you know and understand, the more interesting and involving it becomes. But in any case, to achieve all your goals within our political economic environment, you must have a working understanding of the system and what is going on. You must know how to move within the system and to recognize both opportunities and pitfalls when they come along. Just as we have moved rapidly from manpower to mind power, from land, labor, and capital to knowledge, ideas, and time, we have also moved from a belief that government is the solution to our problems to awareness that government is more often the problem itself. This awareness is gathering steam, and it's being reflected in political activities and elections at every level of American life. The major shift today is from large national government toward smaller state government, and from state governments to local governments and local activities. Just as in business, we are moving from large, entrenched institutions like the Fortune 500 to small and medium-sized companies that are more dynamic and responsive to market forces. We are shifting today from small-scale change to large-scale change, from questioning the established order to overthrowing the established order and erecting a completely different way of living and relating to the community around us. A major shift that is taking place amongst high-performing men and women today is a move away from reliance on government to reliance on self, from giving up responsibility to a larger power to accepting personal responsibility for everything that you do or become. A look back at the historical evolution of our current situation can be quite helpful. I touched on some of these points earlier, but I'd like to repeat them again here. Throughout the entire history of man, up to about 1750, we lived in the agricultural age. Probably 98% of the population lived and worked on the farm, had low levels of productivity, producing small crops when the times were good and no crops when the times were bad. Up until the 18th century, there were an average of 7 famines per year in Europe alone, each one causing the death of many thousands of people. As late as 1839, there was a major famine in Ireland that wiped out a substantial part of the population. The British philosopher David Hume described life during these times as being poor, nasty, brutish, and short. But in 1750, a remarkable thing happened. Inventors began to create machines that replaced slow, painstaking hand labor and produced greater quantities and qualities of product than individuals could accomplish on their own. These early machines were greeted with fear and distrust by the people whose laborious hand labor was being replaced by them, but they were so productive that they began to catch on and proliferate rapidly. Then, in 1776, James Watt invented the steam engine, which permanently replaced manpower and horsepower with steam power. Suddenly, it became possible to operate ever larger machines, and eventually entire factories where vastly greater quantities of products could be manufactured and produced with less time, less labor, and less expense. The first beneficiaries of the Industrial Revolution were the landowners and farmers. The first major applications of new machinery were to agriculture. In a very short period of time, the average farmer or landowner could produce the same size of crop using agricultural machinery that they used to produce using dozens, if not hundreds, of laborers. This advance displaced the laborers and caused them to move toward the cities looking for work and opportunity. In the 19th century, a French economist named Jean-Baptiste Say postulated what came to be known as Say's Law. This is one of the foundation laws of modern economics and modern life, as important as the law of supply and demand. Say's Law simply stated that supply creates its own demand. This meant that when a supply of any factor of production became available, creative entrepreneurs would find a way to use that supply in the production of goods and services that people would buy. When a ready supply of labor developed as people moved from the farms to the cities, industrialists and entrepreneurs took advantage of the labor supply to start businesses and factories of every conceivable size, producing every conceivable type of product or service. After an initial period of disruption, during which unemployed farm laborers banded together and demonstrated against employed factory workers who also banded together to protect their jobs, the expansion of industrial activity eventually absorbed all the laborers available. Between 1815, the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and 1914, the beginning of World War I, the living standard of the average laborer in Britain and America increased 100 times. As machinery became more and more productive, and the availability of skilled labor became the limiting factor in industrial expansion, the owners of the factories and mills had to pay their workers more and more to keep them from taking other jobs offered by other industrialists and entrepreneurs. Because Britain embraced the Industrial Revolution before any other country, it soon became the richest country on earth, and by 1875, 100 years after the invention of the steam engine, the British Empire was the largest empire ever known in human history. It was said then that the sun never set on the British Empire because England controlled lands all over the world as a result of its wealth and manufacturing power. In 1848, as this incredible affluence expanded to everyone within the industrial societies, Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto, calling on the workers of the world to unite. But by the time the ink was dry on this manifesto, it had already been overtaken by events. The workers of the industrialized countries were enjoying rising living standards at a rate unprecedented in all of human history. No one had ever before seen such an incredible increase in wealth and wealth production, most of which quickly trickled down to the people producing the wealth. The Industrial Revolution swept across Europe and across the Atlantic to the United States. In the United States, free from many of the old hierarchical class structures that still plague Europe today, the natural inventiveness and creativity of the independent and self-reliant American entrepreneur triggered an economic explosion that took America from being an agricultural country to an international economic powerhouse in less than a century. Soon, America was the most admired nation in the entire world, and millions of men and women seeking opportunity left everything behind and poured into the United States to live in and take advantage of our free economic system. The greatest natural resource of any nation is, and always has been, the human resource. And since men and women are continually determined to improve their conditions in life, whenever a nation creates an open economic environment, creative individuals rush in to produce goods and services that they can sell to others. The natural competition amongst men and women, each striving to do the very best with their mental, emotional, and physical capital, leads to a continued surge of forward movement that benefits the entire economy and everyone in it. The changes that were brought about in America were dramatic. In 1900, fully 50% of the population lived on the farm, while the other 50% lived in cities. As America rapidly industrialized in the 20th century, the revolution in farm equipment freed up more and more people from the drudgery and long hours of farm labor and enabled them to move into the cities where they could get better jobs paying higher wages and where they could enjoy higher standards of living. Because of Say's Law again, this supply of labor created its own demand. American industrialists created ever larger factories and plants to produce ever greater quantities and qualities of services that soon became the wonder of the entire world. By 1950, only 3% of the population still worked on farms, and they produced more than ever before. And even with all the people moving in from the farms, the standard of the average working man continued to rise dramatically. Soon, the philosophy of meliorism became the accepted philosophy of American life. The philosophy of meliorism simply says that economic and social affairs tend to get better and better over time with the same force as a law of nature. People began to believe that wealth, prosperity, success, happiness, and ever-increasing abundance were inevitable and unstoppable within the American economic system. But of course, every strong set of beliefs creates its opposite. Prior to the Industrial Revolution and the rapid economic growth of the 19th and 20th centuries, virtually everyone was poor. Up until the last century, there were virtually no books or articles written on the subject of poverty. Poverty was as accepted as the sun rising in the east and setting in the west. It was considered to be inevitable. In 1804, Thomas Malthus, the economist, predicted that increasing population growth would eventually lead to widespread famines and the deaths of millions of people. He had no idea at the time that increasing population growth would create a supply of labor that would lead to increasing the quantity of products and services available for more and more people. This is why, in every industrialized country, every new breakthrough in technology has increased the number of higher-paying jobs available, while at the same time it eliminated lower-paying, less interesting work. Today, in the information age, technology is eliminating more and more low-skilled, low-paid jobs and creating more and more opportunities for higher-paying, more interesting work for all of those who make themselves capable of doing these jobs to the continued acquisition of knowledge and skills. In 1900, the total tax burden on the American people was approximately 2% of the gross national product. There was one government servant for every 72 Americans. Today, of course, it is one government servant for every 4.5 Americans. It was generally assumed at that time that no country could tax more than 5 or 6% of the gross national product without causing a severe backlash among the population. But then, along came World War I and massive involvement of the government in the national economy. People were willing to accept a higher level of government involvement in taxation because of the national emergency created by the war. With the continued expansion of business and industry and the opportunities to create wealth, another interesting twist took place. People began to believe that because America was so prosperous, governments could afford to take a little away from those who were doing well and give a little to those who weren't doing quite as well. The general ideas of socialism, which call for the control of the means of production in a society, as well as control of the distribution of the goods produced, began to become increasingly popular amongst intellectuals and economists. Because of the doctrine of Meliorism, the doctrine that things get better and better over time, no matter what you do, it became generally accepted that governments could take more and more from those who had and give more and more to those who had less. The ideas of redistribution became quite popular amongst those who saw themselves in an intermediary position where they would be in charge of taking the fruits of production away from those who had produced them and giving those same fruits to those who had produced nothing. They would have positions of power and authority and get credit for handing out the free money to the beneficiaries. There's a saying in economics that the person who promises to take away from Peter to give to Paul will always have the support of Paul. Since in every society the number of people who are doing extremely well is usually quite small, it became an easy thing for governments of all kinds to get support for various taxes on the successful, both individuals and corporations. Even Alexis de Tocqueville, who toured America in 1830 and wrote his famous book Democracy in America, observed that America is prosperous because Americans look to themselves to create their own prosperity. He also observed that if Americans ever get the idea that it is easier for them to get the things they want by supporting government actions to expropriate the property of others rather than by working for it themselves, it will signal the end of the American experiment in democracy and self-government. From being a nation founded on the principles of individualism, private property, limited government, personal excellence, and personal responsibility, over the decades, many Americans moved toward seeing government as a source of wealth, especially unearned wealth, that they could get if they positioned themselves properly within the political system. Soon, large industries and corporations began hiring lobbyists and supporting politicians who would give them special privileges and opportunities to get wealth without producing it. Today, this is known by the economic term rent-seeking. Rent-seeking is when a company or industry gets a piece of legislation passed that enables it to charge more for its product or service than it could get on the open market in open competition with other providers of the product or service. Often these rent-seeking devices are in the forms of special legislation, import barriers, regulations on the design or structure of particular products, and restrictions on the activities of competitors. But supply creates its own demand. As soon as one individual, group, or organization sees a competitor getting a special benefit from a special piece of legislation, that individual or organization immediately begins looking for ways to get similar benefits for itself. Soon, government becomes a grabbing match with everyone trying to benefit at the expense of everyone else. And of course, politicians who offer the very best combination of taking from one group to give to another tend to attract financial and political support and be elected to office. In order to get support for their individual ideas and pieces of legislation, they find themselves having to support others in passing their pet projects and pieces of legislation. The modern term to describe this is log rolling. This is where politicians each support each other to pass the legislation needed to satisfy the voters who sent them there in the first place. Soon, all political debate revolves around who is going to take what from whom and how much and on what basis and how much is going to be given to whom and for what reason. Modern politics becomes a grabbing match amongst various political factions, each trying to get the money that they promised to their constituents in order to get elected, and, they hope, to get reelected. J. James Buchanan, the Nobel Prize winner in economics from the University of Chicago, earned his prize with his research and conclusions on what he called public choice economics. He said that you could predict how any politician would vote by simply examining the opinion polls in that politician's constituency and finding out what the majority wanted and how they wanted it. Politicians would then put aside principles, policies, and values in striving to package their offerings to the electorate in such a way that they could win the election, very much like a bidder would win at an auction by offering the highest price. The combined tax take in the United States in the year 1900 was approximately 2% of the gross national product. By 1920, the total tax take had risen to about 5% of the gross national product at federal, state, and local levels. By 1940, the beginning of World War II, the total national tax take was still only 11%. And this was after the decade of the 30s, when the federal government intervened in more areas of the economy than anyone had ever dreamed possible prior to the economic debacle of the Depression. But World War II changed Americans' attitude toward the government and what it was capable of doing. Up to that time, Americans had been very skeptical of government activity of any kind, resisting the attempts of politicians to expand the role of government through taxation and regulation that benefited small groups at the expense of the majority. But World War II created an enormous demand for a total national effort that had to be supervised by the federal government at all levels. By the time the war was over, people had unconsciously accepted a massive role for the federal government in national life. In the 50s, taxes and regulations began to gradually increase, all in the name of somehow improving the overall standard of living of Americans. These increases accelerated as politicians, with more and more ideas on how to spend money, found themselves running up against taxpayers who were increasingly resistant to paying higher and higher taxes. So, the politicians spent the money anyway and financed it with either large deficits, borrowed money, or with printing press money that led to inflation. Of course, there were politicians crying out like voices in the wilderness against the growth of government through increased taxes and regulation. But the American economy was so powerful that it kept moving ahead like a locomotive, even though it was continually being burdened by ever higher taxes and ever more onerous regulations. Today, fully 43% of the gross national product is taken by governments at all levels. This means that 43% of everything you earn, on average, goes to various governments to be spent by them on projects and activities of various kinds. This is causing serious problems within our society, all of which are manifested in public debates and political elections. However, in the 80s, the average American began to recognize that government is the problem, not the solution. As Albert J. Nock pointed out as early as 1944 in his book, Our Enemy, the State, government has no wealth of its own. The only wealth that government has comes from what it takes away from the average citizen in the form of taxation. Nock pointed out that the American Constitution and Bill of Rights was a series of protections for the people against the arbitrary use of government power to tax and regulate. He recognized that our biggest potential enemy was the unlimited growth of government through taxation and regulation, to the point where it could strangle individual initiative and entrepreneurial activity. Fortunately, a revolution in thought is taking place. Honest men and women have finally realized that it is not possible to have something for nothing. It is not possible over the long term to consume without producing. Honest Americans today realize that if someone is going to consume without producing, someone else must produce without consuming. The average person today recognizes that corporations pay no taxes. Corporations merely collect taxes in the form of higher prices and pass the money on to the government after adding substantial carrying charges to compensate them for the expense of doing the government accounting. Corporations pay no taxes. All the talk of raising taxes on companies is silly. If the taxes are so high that people will not buy the product or service because it's priced out of the market, the companies merely move their activities overseas to where there are lower taxes and regulations and cheaper labor, and manufacture overseas and ship the products back at a price that Americans are now willing to pay. It's always been this way, and it will always be this way. Corporations pay no taxes. The wonderful philosophical shift taking place in America today is away from a reliance on governments and back toward a reliance on self. It is toward helping people to help themselves to become proud, contributing, self-reliant members of society. Because of the value or principle of benevolence We are all in favor of helping those who cannot help themselves. But we also recognize that when you help people for too long or with too much, they become dependent on free money provided by others, and they gradually lose their own sense of self-reliance, self-respect, and self-esteem. By making people dependent on government, it hurts both the person who is forced to pay and the recipient. There's no faster way to destroy the personal pride of an individual than to make him or her dependent on an arbitrary source of income outside themselves. The key issue, as always, is the issue of control. You and I need to feel that we are in control of our own lives to be happy, and so does everyone else. We are moving from the idea of government control to the idea of personal control. We know that people are only happy and productive when they feel that they are in charge of their lives and are in control of what they do and the rewards of their efforts. Your job is to become a totally self-sufficient, self-responsible, self-reliant individual, dependent on no one and nothing for the things that you want to be, do, and have in life. As a result, you have a tremendous feeling of self-respect, self-esteem, and personal pride, and you want this same feeling for others as well. There are two fundamental flaws in modern thinking that can trip you up and interfere with your success. The first is the something-for-nothing idea, and the second is the quick-fix idea. The something-for-nothing idea is like a computer virus that infects the operation of the entire system. Many people have the idea that it's possible to get something for nothing, that it's possible to get more back than they put in, that there's somehow, somewhere, a free lunch that they can get a share of if they are clever or lucky. You see this desire for something for nothing all around you, in the people who are constantly looking for get-rich-quick schemes, wealth without working, easy money, and promotion based on politics rather than on performance. The very idea that it is possible to reap without sowing is a violation of the iron law, the cosmic law of cause and effect. And any attempt to violate a universal law brings about consequences that are usually far worse than the individual can anticipate. One of the most important things you do is to take the pledge. Take the pledge and promise yourself that you will never take anything for nothing. Promise yourself that you do not want anything that you have not worked for and justly earned. Make a decision that you will never be led astray by the temptations of what appear to be easy money or rewards not accompanied by hard work. This pledge is the ultimate statement of the truly honest person. When you can say with complete sincerity that you don't want anything that you're not entitled to as a result of your hard work and contribution, you'll feel terrific about yourself. Your way of looking at your world and the opportunities around you will change completely. Once you've taken this pledge yourself, encourage your spouse and children to take it as well. And when you stop looking for shortcuts, you will, by the principle of the excluded alternative, begin concentrating all of your efforts on the real important things that you can do that will bring you the success that you desire. The second mental virus affecting many Americans is the idea of the quick fix. This idea suggests that it's possible to solve problems that have taken many years to develop quickly and without effort. It's amazing how many people are led astray by the idea of finding a quick, easy, pain-free, low-cost or no-cost solution to their difficulties. All of the advertisements suggesting that there's a quick and easy way to accomplish your goals and achieve the health, wealth, and satisfaction you desire are aimed to appeal to this fundamental flaw in the characters of many people. But you know that anything worthwhile usually takes a long time to create. If you want to be healthy, it takes you many weeks and months of proper diet, proper exercise, proper rest, and proper attitude to achieve health of both mind and body. If you want to be wealthy, it takes many years of study, preparation, practice, and application to develop yourself to the point where you can make a contribution to others that enables you to enjoy a good living well in excess of your daily expenses. If you want to have happy relationships with others, it requires a long-term investment of yourself, both in becoming a better person and then in doing everything possible to uplift and enhance the lives of the people you care about. There is no such thing as a quick fix. When people combine the twin temptations of the something-for-nothing and the quick fix, you have a recipe for personal and political problems that can go on for years. But when you decide that you do not want something for nothing, and that you will not look for quick fix solutions to solve your problems or achieve your goals, you move yourself into the category of persons for whom long-term success in life is virtually guaranteed. The essence of political economy and all advanced, mature thinking is the careful and accurate consideration of the likely consequences of a particular decision or action. Virtually everything that you do is done to achieve a benefit or an improvement of some kind. This is normal and natural. But knowing what we know of human nature and the tendency toward the line of least resistance, the most important question is not the short-term benefit, but the long-term consequence. What is likely to happen as a result of engaging in a particular behavior? Your ability to accurately calculate the long-term consequences of a behavior and to think long-term in this sense is the key to your making the right decisions in the short term that lead to the long-term consequences that you really want. The immediate benefits of spending all the money you make and a little bit more besides are obvious. You have a nice place to live, a nice car, nice food, nice clothes, and a good social life. But the long-term consequences of spending everything and putting nothing aside can be disastrous. They may not occur for a week, a month, a year, or even several years, but there is nothing so terrible as to reach your 60s with no savings and being forced to subsist on Social Security and part-time work doing menial tasks. In your life and in the life of your community and in the area of political economy, the long-term potential consequences must be paramount in the making of any decision. Knowing what we know of human nature and the tendency of people to act expediently in almost every situation, what is likely to happen as the result of a particular decision or behavior? Your job is to make the decisions and to implement the behaviors and activities that will assure that your long-term contains the health, happiness, and prosperity that you most desire. And remember, everything counts. Everything you do either helps or hurts. Everything you do either adds up or takes away. There's a law in political economy called the law of unintended consequences. This law says that even the most well-meaning of policies, if they violate universal laws of cause and effect, sowing and reaping, action and reaction, will bring about consequences that were totally unintended by the authors of the laws. Attempting to help the less fortunate, which we all want to do, by making the rewards for not working greater than the rewards for working, ultimately destroys the character of the recipient of the benefits. Protecting a particular industry through special subsidies and regulations ultimately makes that industry uncompetitive with companies that have no such protections. Raising wage rates far beyond what a person could earn in the free market ultimately destroys the business or industry and wipes out those jobs forever. Everywhere and in every situation, you see the law of unintended consequences at work. At the beginning of this program, I said that everything you accomplish on the outside is determined by the quality of your thinking on the inside. This is absolutely true in every area of human life. When you improve the quality of your thinking, you improve the quality of your life. In any area of your life where you are discontented for any reason, it is up to you to examine your current thinking patterns and to change them so that they are more consistent with the new realities. The purpose of this entire program has been to give you a series of new thinking skills, master strategies, and to show you the shifts that have taken place from thinking in one way based on the past to thinking in newer and more productive ways based on the realities of the present and future. Those men and women who are the early adapters who recognize that a whole new shift in thinking is necessary in virtually every field will be those who rise to the top and become the movers and shakers throughout our society. We are living in the golden age of mankind. There have never been more opportunities for you to fulfill your potential and become all you are capable of becoming than there are today. It is up to you to become a master of change rather than a victim of change, to become a creator of circumstances rather than a creature of circumstances. It's up to you to take your future destiny in your own two hands and to make of it what you will. It is up to you to become a totally self-reliant, self-responsible, forward-looking, goal-oriented, highly productive individual. By going to work on yourself and on your own thinking, you can bring about every change and improvement that you desire in your external world. And by committing yourself to yourself and to the creation of a wonderful life in the years ahead, your future will be unlimited.
If you enjoyed this program from Master Motivator and Success Coach Brian Tracy, you are probably the type of high achiever that would benefit from Brian Tracy's personal success coaching program. This one-on-one coaching program is unlike any self-development tool ever offered. Imagine spending 12 weeks with your own coach who has been personally trained by Brian Tracy. Your coach will aid you on building your life strategies, guiding you as you take action steps toward making your greatest desires a reality. If you are like many, you often set goals, but sometimes lack the motivation to carry them through. With the ongoing nurturing and guidance of your personal coach and this outstanding program, you will be accountable for the changes you want to make in your life, and you'll soon see those changes becoming a reality. Created exclusively for Nightingale Konat by Brian Tracy, this program has had massive life-changing results on those that have committed themselves to it. It consists of a minimum of 12 weeks of 30-minute one-on-one telecoaching sessions with a trained personal coach. Accompanying the program are 12 cassette tapes, one for each week of study, along with a guidebook. This extraordinary program focuses on every aspect of your life and helps to integrate and balance your life success skills along with your business growth. Brian Tracy's Personal Success Coaching Program offers you guidance in the areas of strategic planning, intelligence, health and fitness, power, career success, time management, financial planning, life success, relationships, goal setting, leadership, and building character. Your life will magically transform as you turn your conceptualized thoughts into active steps toward achieving your goals. Brian Tracy's Personal Success Coaching Program is one of the most comprehensive, powerful self-development programs to date and is designed to fit your goals, dreams, and desires, both personally and professionally. Act now, today, and call in to receive further information and your free personal success profile with one of our trained personal development representatives. Designed with Brian Tracy, this profile will identify your strengths and pinpoint your growth opportunities. We offer this analysis to you at no cost and no obligation, so don't delay. To register for this outstanding coaching program or to receive your free personal success profile, call Nightingale Konat now at this number, 1-877-297-9799. That's 1-877-297-9799 and ask for Brian Tracy's Personal Success Coaching Profile. It's one phone call that could change your life.